Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
You will remember that we were talking to Liam, who was refereeing an under-18s match, when he quite literally dropped dead. I asked him the question, what happened? Were there bright lights? Was there a tunnel? Was there choirs of angels? And he said, no, nothing. Not even crickets, just zero. That was it. Well, that prompted Anya to pick up the phone because she had a very, very different near-death experience, or actual death and coming back experience. Anya, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Grand.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it, and I'm glad to hear that you've lived full, happy, healthy life since this happened to you in 1984. But when you were ill, very seriously ill with septic shock, wasn't it? What happened to you?
It was. We were in the first year of our marriage, and I got a very, very bad pain around my tummy kind of area and my side. So it was particularly bad. And when I looked in the mirror, my face kind of looked green, you know. So
you got to the doctors. And what was the last thing?
The house, actually.
Okay.
Yes.
And what was the last thing that you remember before going unconscious?
Well, the doctor sent me into hospital. The hospital sent me down for an ultrasound. And during the ultrasound, I remember the doctor saying to me, you look very, very pale. How are you feeling? And I said, I just feel numb. And she said, and where do you feel the numbness? I said, it's creeping up my body. And so she was checking in with me. And the last thing that I heard her say was, where is the numbness now? And it was at my chest, and I was gone.
And you weren't able to reply to her?
No. I went into a coma. I'd never heard about this before, but it was as if I was on the ceiling, looking down at myself in the bed, totally disconnected from myself in the bed. And I could see myself lying in the bed. There was a priest anointing me. There was a doctor trying to get a pulse. And my husband was holding my hand.
And had that actually happened in the room, Anya? Was there a priest anointing you, giving you the last rites?
There was, yes, but I was unconscious at the time. So,
okay, but this is my point. You had no way of knowing this because
you were unconscious.
This is, your husband was able to tell you what was happening. He was there holding your hand as the priest
was giving
you the last rites.
Hand. Yeah, and so I remember going through a tunnel, it was very, very peaceful. And I felt as if I was being accompanied. I didn't feel on my own. And I was going towards a beautiful, bright light. And it's the kind of light, a fluorescent light, you know, that colour of white. But a fluorescent light is very harsh on your eyes.
Mm.
But this was that colour, but soft.
How did you feel?
I felt I was heading home. I really felt I couldn't get there fast enough. I felt as if I was nearly in moon boots, you know.
Okay.
I just couldn't get there fast enough.
And was there a part of you that rationalised this and said, I'm dying, this must be what dying is like?
No. No, I basically was in that moment. I wasn't anywhere else except in that tunnel, heading towards the beautiful, soft, welcoming light.
Okay. And it wasn't scary. It was euphoric.
No, no. It was beautiful and it was so peaceful. And I felt that the light was so gentle. And I could see this figure in the light. And I just knew I was going back home. I felt, this is home. I wanted to go there.
Who was the figure?
Well, to me, the figure was Jesus, because I would be, I'd go to Mass on Sundays, I'd be a Catholic, but I would be very spiritual. So to me, it looked like Jesus welcoming me home.
And was it just an idea of Jesus, Anya, or was it the traditional representation of man with long hair, beard and flowing robes?
No, it was, I actually painted an image of what I saw, and it was a figure with shoulder length hair and just surrounded by light, but with his arms out in welcome.
Okay.
But it was very, very peaceful, and I just wanted to go home. And then my husband was, I could see my husband, and he was crying, and he was saying, don't leave me, Anya, don't leave me. And with that, I was back. Now, there was no reversing back or doing anything at all. I literally was back in my body. And they all got a fright, because my own GP, they had phoned him and they said that all my vital organs had shut down, and they said, we've given her an hour to live. So it was, now I wasn't aware of any of that, but no. I do remember when I came back, I wanted to actually go to the beautiful place that I saw.
And you still have a strong memory of it. Rewind the clock for me. You were 29 years of age when this happened.
Yes.
Rewind the clock to 28-year-old you. If you had heard somebody telling this account on the radio, what would your reaction to it have been?
Well, I would have been open to listening to what they had to say. I would be quite an open person. I would have heard it and maybe forgotten about it, you know, but I would have been open to a person having an experience that rationally we probably can't. We find it hard to rationalize it,
So you're saying that you would have said that's what they believe happened to them, but I'm quite happy to accept that that's what they feel, but I'm not so sure that is what actually happened. Is that what you're saying?
No, I wouldn't doubt them. If they believe that that happened to them, I think I would be very inquisitive. I would have a very inquisitive kind of mind.
Okay.
I don't think people go around telling lies or whatever, or far-fetched stories just to, maybe some people do. But in general, I think that people say it as it is.
Absolutely. I mean, the sincerity is oozing out of every pore of you. I mean, I absolutely believe what it is that you're saying to me is something that you feel that you experienced. Fast forward then from 29 to the present day and all of the intervening years. How has the experience changed you, changed how you feel about death?
Oh, I I'm not afraid of dying at all. And in fact, I got involved in bereavement counselling, and I have had two very close friends who've both died, and I was able to reassure them that when the time would come, that it would be very peaceful. You know, it is a peaceful going home. You're going back to the source, whatever.
Okay, and did they believe you?
As the source. Yes. They actually did, and they found comfort in it. And in fact, some people who wouldn't have known me, and I would be working with them in the counselling, and they would say, God, that gives me such reassurance that my loved one is happy. And because some people wouldn't maybe, you know, have had a chance to say goodbye to their loved one, and they'd be gone, you know, they would die.
When you listened to Liam yesterday saying that for him, it was nothing. It was the big sleep. There was just absolutely no sensation for him to report on. Can you accept that that's an absolute truth for him, and that he has no reason to tell it otherwise?
No, of course. No, that's his story. I think we all have our own story. And but it just prompted me to phone, because my experience was different. And
and thank you for the call, because what I'm fascinated by is the extent to which, since this experience in 1984, has ended up centering you and making you feel happier in your approach to life. And you sound like somebody who's very much at peace with themselves.
I am, yes. And I've two gorgeous girls in their 30s and a lovely husband. And he said to me, he validated everything that was happening, but he said, you were unconscious. He said, you know, he was told that I had an hour to live. All my organs had shut down. I had gone into septic shock.
Yeah. Okay, let me bring in some other people who have had experiences similar and dissimilar to your own. Seamus, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Philip. How are you, sir? I'm very well, thank you.
What happened to you? How similar was it to Anya's experience?
Very similar. October 2004, we were on holidays in Elvore in the Algarve, and I just got this drastic pain in the head in the morning, really bad. It was like your worst hangover multiplied by 10, all of a sudden, came out of the blue. It turned out to be an aneurysm. My wife Anne was obviously with me, got a fright. We had our two children were quite young. Connor was 8, I think, and Connor might have been 10 and growing. He was about 12. And my wife contacted the hotel. They sent on a doctor.
And the response of the medical team, Seamus, was to put you into an induced coma for your own medical protection, as it were. Now, once you were under, what happened?
Well, I was brought up to Lisbon to be operated on, so they were putting clips in my brain for the operation. But while I was in the coma, I'm not sure whether it was in the coma or before or after the operation, I felt like I was floating along in a cloud, kind of a circular cloud. And I met, at the end of the cloud, was my father and mother. I got a bit emotional this morning when I was talking to your researcher about this. So I'm trying to keep myself together with this. I met the two of them. My mother had died in 1980. My father had died in 1984 from a stroke. My mother had died from cancer in 1989. This is minimum 15 years later. They were both, my father, ironically enough, my father had a suit. The only time he wore a suit was going to Mass on Sunday morning, as he was a fisherman. And my mother was sitting on a chair. He was standing over her. And they said, go back. So, after the operation, I just woke up. And
well, hang on, Seamus, stay with them for a second. Yeah. Was it a conversation or was it a feeling of I'm just with my parents?
Oh, no. I was floating in the cloud and I just met them in a room. She was sitting on a chair. I remember this as if it was yesterday, you know. Mm. It's kind of weird because this was no dream. Your normal dream, you're like, actually, you forget that the day after. This is as clear to me now as it was then. I'm not a religious person.
Yeah, but what happened here? I mean, was it, hello, ma'am, hello, dad, ah, Shamie, how are you? Or just that simple one exchange, go back?
No, they said to me, go back, your time isn't up. And that's all they said. I couldn't say it the first time around because I was getting a bit emotional there. So, I was back. The operation was obviously done at that stage. But they subsequently told me, the great people in the hospital said that I was resuscitated at some point throughout the operation. So apparently I nearly died. But obviously I have no memory of that because I wasn't awake at the time. But
And Seamus, the same question to you as I asked of Áine. Rewind to 2003, before this holiday in the Algarve, and if you had heard somebody relating your experience, this experience on the radio, what would you have thought of it?
Yeah, I would have been a bit sceptical, to be quite honest with you, because I left the church behind many years ago, so I probably would not have believed them. But what it has crystallized for me is that there is another dimension to life. It's just not just what we have here. That is a fact. That's my takeaway from it.
Yeah, that's a fact for you. And does that being a fact in your life give you hope, give you comfort, or does it scare you?
Oh, no, it doesn't scare me. No. Every year, every birthday, I go, I'm happy that I reached the next one. I'm 66 now, and I hope I last another few years. Yes. So, no, life is good, and I have no regrets.
And does it make you believe that when your time does eventually come, many years from now, hopefully, Seamus, that your mother and father will be there waiting for you?
I'm not so sure that will happen. All I can relate is exactly what happened to me.
Okay.
It's what my memory of that time. I do know that the Irish embassy was brilliant in Spain and Portugal, and they were basically asking my wife, you know, would I be buried or cremated, kind of thing. It was that serious. So all I can really talk about is what happened on that time, and there is definitely another dimension to life after we pass away in this life.
The Irish Embassy looking after you in this dimension, not necessarily in the next, so far as we know anyway. What, your son was 10 at the time, was he?
He was, yeah.
What was his experience of this?
Well, as it happened, your researcher wanted to verify what happened, you know, as in, obviously, you guys need proof that we're not just chancing our arm here. He actually walked in the middle of the conversation I was having with your researcher, and he spoke directly to your researcher and gave his experience of it. He's not here with me now. He's gone off somewhere. I think you have his number. But
what was his experience?
He was obviously very young, and the do you know, I'm not exactly sure what he said to your researcher, quite honestly. You really have to say it to himself. He was very young. I was out of it, if you know what I mean.
And this is upsetting stuff. I mean, it is particularly upsetting, isn't it, when you think of the children that you are going to leave behind when you do move on. That's a very, very hard thing to be able to absorb. Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing that. And Anya, thank you very much for sharing your experience as well. Well, there you go. Liam's story yesterday. There's a big fat nothing at the end of it all. And Anya and Seamus' experience is very, very different. Who's to know? Who's to know? Thank you, though, very much, Anya and Seamus. Let's take a break.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
OK, back to where we started at the top of the programme at the Minister for Education, Helen McEntee, and setting out some of the terms of that commission of investigation to look into allegations of sexual abuse in all schools, not just religious schools, all schools. Paul, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Philip. How are you?
What are your feelings hearing this news today?
Well, I'm delighted that there is an inquiry into the whole thing, but I would like to see it extended to people who suffered physical abuse, as it was known then, now with corporal punishment, as we know it better. I would like that to be included as well, because thousands and thousands of people, including myself, went through hell in primary school, national school. And I think that should be looked at as well.
And if it doesn't, Paul, and I can't say conclusively because we haven't seen the actual terms of reference, but it does appear to just revolve around allegations of sexual abuse. If it doesn't, what does that do to you?
Well, what it does to me is it sounds like it doesn't matter or it didn't affect anybody, but I can tell you that it did. And lots of people took their lives because of it. It's that bad, and I know sexual abuse is an awful crime, but physical abuse every single day is not nice either, I can tell you.
How long ago were you in school?
Oh, you're talking about the mid-50s, early 60s.
And I can tell by you that this is still with you today in 2025.
There's not a day goes by that I don't think about it.
What happened?
We were due to get a new principal in the school, and she was arriving this Monday morning, and we're all excited about this new teacher, you know. It was a two-teacher school, and we heard her outside when she arrived. She was talking to the other teacher out in the corridor, and I was sitting in the very back seat. There was those long wooden seats. I don't know whether you remember them or not. Mm-hmm. You probably never sat in any of those for them. They were long wooden seats with inkwells in them. And I was sitting in the very back seat on the outside. And when the door opened for her to come in, I just looked around to look at her. And with that, she just drew out and hit me right across the face.
Sorry, before she had said hello to the class?
Before she opened her mouth. That was our introduction, right across the face. She nearly knocked me off the seat.
So that was her laying down a marker.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
And where did it go from there?
That was to continue practically every day for the rest of my life in that school. Practically every single day. No, I wasn't the only one that got it, but I seemed to get particular attention for whatever reason, I don't know. Which was with a stick on the back of the legs, on the back of the neck, on your knuckles. Yeah, it was every day.
Paul, were you ever able to enjoy the idea of going to school, or was it just something that was terror-filled every day?
No, I was shaking every morning that I had to get up and go to school. Shaking, and there was nobody you could talk to, because they seemed to think it was the way things were done, you know, it was acceptable. We never knew what we were being beaten for, ever.
Did it get better in secondary school, Paul?
Oh, much better, yeah. Actually, the funny thing about it is that the principal in the secondary school was that lady's husband that was battered in us.
Are you kidding me?
He was an absolute gentleman, an absolute gentleman.
Okay.
So many years later, by the way, well, not that many, about 10 years ago, I was attending my brother's funeral, and the other teacher that was in that school came to sympathise with us at the funeral. And I just she was shaking my hand and sympathising with me, and I just burst out and I says, you knew that. I didn't want to name her. Yeah, I knew. You knew she was beating us. I said, why didn't you do something? She just turned around and said to me, there was nothing we could do. There was nobody we could talk to. There was no systems in place to talk to anybody. That's the answer I got.
Paul, what you went through wasn't corporal punishment, wasn't physical abuse. It was just torture, absolute
torture. Yeah.
Torture. There was days
I wet myself. Philip, there's no doubt. I wet myself with fear. And you couldn't learn in those circumstances. You just couldn't learn anything.
I suppose in doing what they are doing today, the government is saying, right, look, you know, we can't just sweep this under the carpet any longer. We have to address it. And in so doing, we have to set some kind of limitations to it, because if we're to take every single person who ever got a belt of a cane or a duster or anything up to and including the kind of abuse and torture that you suffered, and there would be no limitations to it. I mean, you would just be talking about vast, vast numbers of people and a process that would in itself never end. That's not to say that you and your experience should be discounted or should be excluded from this, but have you any ideas on how you square that circle?
I don't. I agree with what you're saying there, because this is widespread, probably in every school. I don't know. Doesn't make life any easier for us anyway.
No.
Doesn't. And I think it affected my education as well, you know, because I didn't do very well at school.
How could you?
My education.
Absolutely. Maybe, because one of the things that she says here in her statement, the Minister for Education, was there is this question that they are very open-minded about memorialisation and how do we properly mark and commemorate is the wrong word, but acknowledge in sufficiently public kind of way what it is that happened. Have you any ideas on that? Would you be minded to make a suggestion to the Commission of Investigation?
Not really, no. I think there's people more qualified to do that than me. But I would like it to be acknowledged anyway that it happened and it was going on for years and years and nothing done about it.
I don't know if this even begins to scratch the surface of it, but something outside your school that says, while this has been a place of joy and learning for many people, for others, that wasn't the experience and we must never forget that.
Yeah, that's the case, all right, yeah.
But is that of any satisfaction or consolation to you, or is that just a sort of a half measure?
No, it wouldn't give me much satisfaction, though, to be honest with you.
Okay. And have you thought about what would, Paul?
I'd love to see these people brought to answer questions, but I'd say they're all deceased now at this stage. You know, I think it's, you know, thank God it's not happened. I have three grandchildren, and I think they go to school happy every morning, they come home happy, and it's great to see, you know, and they do well at school, you know, educational wise. But that wasn't the case in our day.
Now, I
have to say, you know, that not every teacher was like that, you know, but...
No, but it doesn't matter. It only takes one to blight a life, as happened to you.
Yeah.
Stay there, though. Let me bring in Damien O'Farrell. Damien, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for talking to us. So what are your thoughts now in response to what you've heard the minister say?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to say to Paul that, look, I heard what he had to say. And I would like, even though I'm a victim of the sexual abuse side, the day school sexual abuse, it would be nice to see a scheme for everybody. So some people, you know, there was some children. I went through that system of corporal punishment, and there was some boys beaten with a leather, you know, on their hand. But there was others that I witnessed that were brutalised, hit with hurley sticks, punched in the face, kicked on the ground. You know, so that can't be left. That can't be left. No. And I think it's about, you talked about memorialisation there, and the best memorialisation, I think, would be a proper redress scheme that this nation can be proud of. That's not just transactional. That includes everybody. That's not just transactional. And it's transformational. And it's not just about money. You know, it transforms people's lives. So that would be the best. But I give cautious welcome to the minister. Look, she kept to her promise. We're having a commission of investigation. That's in the programme of government. So that's what she's having. She's announced that today. So I'd welcome that. But I'd give cautious welcome, I suppose. Because I work now, as I said, I'm a day survivor of school. I work now for SAGE Advocacy. We advocate for victims that were in industrial schools and reformatory schools, and they went through a redress scheme in the early 2000s.
And tell me...
That brutalised them again. Like, so I'm dealing with that. You know, I bear witness to that every day.
Yeah, I know. It can be just as daunting, the prospect of actually reopening all of these old wounds. But, Damien, you know... In drawing this distinction between sexual abuse and physical abuse, it strikes me that you would be essentially excluding or denying a very significant part of your story in only talking about the sexual abuse and not about the brutalisation and the punishment.
Yeah, I wasn't brutalised. I would have been leathered, I suppose, every week. You know,
there's plenty of people consider that pretty brutal,
weeks,
Damien.
Yeah, most weeks. But I saw guys like being brutalised, you know, kicked on the ground and punched in the face, hit with hurley sticks. Mm-hmm. Not that often, but I witnessed it. And at that time, it was very much the same as the sexual abuse. It happened to be that what I witnessed, it happened to be a member of a religious order, and he was moved to another school. And that was the very same thing happened with sexual abuse, that they, at that time, they were moved around to the schools. So a lot of victims know that we have a commission of investigation, but a lot of people know what happened. We know what happened. And I think the country is probably get a greater shock when we look under the bonnet to see the amount of collusion and the amount of, the amount of that just moved around, the amount of lies and children in different parts of the country where the perpetrator would be sent to that village or that school, another school, more abuse. And
it's another reckoning. There's no doubt about it whatsoever. Let me go back to, once again, what it is that is a satisfactory outcome for you. You say redress. The government says, well, this is going to be funded by the schools and by the religious orders and where this abuse took place. So if that means that we... You know, do just the straightforward maths of saying they will get whatever money they can get out of the people who were responsible for this abuse and divide it equally amongst all of those who were abused. Is that sufficient, even if it only ends up being a token sum of money?
Yeah, there is symbolic justice, is what you're talking there. But redress, it's not just redress. It's not just transactional. Like the people listening to your program today that were sexually abused and that were physically abused and all. And I know this commission investigation is for people who are sexually abused. It's not all about money for those people. It's about some justice. It's about somebody who was listening to them. So a commission investigation, we don't want to jump ahead of ourselves, a commission investigation that would get into all that and would get truth, because we haven't really had truth. You know, we haven't really had truth, so we'd get truth. And then a redress scheme that wouldn't be just, it's not all about money. It's just people talk about victims. That's very transactional. There's other supports that being given that can be given to survivors. There's advocacy, there's health, there's health support, certain medical cards, there's educational supports, there's other supports. And as I said, the industrial school people, and they went through a redress scheme in the early 90s. They were brutalised. They were put back in front of the people that sent them into the industrial schools in the first place in courts to say their stories again. So we want to move away from that. And I'm sure, I think, in fairness, I think as a country, we have moved away from that.
Indeed, you know, well, she promises, the minister promises a survivor-centred and a trauma-informed process, and one that will take place behind closed doors. So hopefully nobody ends up in an adversarial situation that only re-traumatises them. Talk to me, though, just before I let you go, about what this process feels like now. Is this an opening of the shutters and letting the sunshine pour in kind of moment, or is it the reopening of an old wound?
No, I think as I said at the start, it's a very cautious welcome, because when you there's a thing that I believe it's called secondary abuse. You know, you can be abused a second time. So when you're abused the first time by the perpetrator, and there wasn't much, you know, that happened. But when the state or when somebody puts a hand out to you and they want you to come into the room, they're being welcomed into this situation. Survivors are being welcomed into the room. We're being welcomed in to give our stories, a redress scheme has been, you know, a commission of investigation. And if that's not done properly, that can be very traumatic. And that's secondary abuse. And that's the second abuse. And it can be as bad or worse, I would say, than the first abuse. How you're treated by the people that are supposed to help you, how you're treated by the religious orders. So there's people around the country listening to your show now that are not being treated well by religious orders. When I say religious orders, I mainly mean the leaderships of the religious orders, because there's very good, there's good priests, there's good nuns, good sisters, good brothers. But the leadership, when they don't, as I said, the Christian Brothers have a litigation strategy it's not victims focused, and that's a second abuse. It's a double abuse.
Okay. Well, we have
so
to
this
be
process.
Yeah.
So when you're bringing people into a process, you have to be very careful
that you don't do worse and don't compound the damage that has already been done. Okay.
Look, exactly.
Damien, thanks. Paul, thank you very much.
Philip.
Yeah. Sorry. Go on, Paul. Yeah.
Before I let you go, I think you're a shoo-in for this job.
I'm going
into Paddy Power in the afternoon to throw a few bob on you.
Keep your money in your pocket, Paul. We'll take a break. Bye-bye.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Well, I tell you what I did not have on my Tuesday the 8th of July bingo card. It was the number of people who have died and come back to us and for whom there has been bright shining lights. B. Morehouse, first to you. What happened? Big nothing or the lights and the pull of something angelic?
Hi, Philip. No, I went into a hospital last April, 12 months, for a very minor trigger finger operation. And I had a general anaesthetic for it. And I don't know what happened, but I seemed to be in a waiting room. And there was a few people in the waiting room, but there was one man in particular who I don't know who it was, but he was tall and he was sitting under a window. And then I was asked, did I want to live or die? And I said, no, I know I'm dying. So I went into sort of a whirlwind then, and then I came to again and I was asked again, do I want to live or die? And I said, I want to live. And with that, I went into a tunnel and there was the most beautiful colours, mauves and greens and blues. and I went through that tunnel, but I had to fight so hard to wake up. That was the hardest thing I ever did, was, you know, wake up, physically wake up. And I did. And when I did, I was in a different hospital. My daughter was one side of the bed. I was in a different hospital in ICU. My daughter was one side of the bed and my husband was crying on the other side of the bed. And I just woke up. And that was it.
And how would you describe it, Bea? Was it a particularly vivid dream or was it a different quality of experience?
It was... No, it wasn't a dream. It definitely wasn't a dream. It was the only thing, Philip, I can tell you is that it's made me unafraid of dying.
Well, that's good. But it was not a dream. It actually felt like you were physically going through these experiences of trying to claw your way back to life.
Yeah, I was going through it. But the thing about me is that I never, ever wanted to talk about anything like that or dying or life. No, I would never read anything about people's experiences or anything.
And you didn't have any belief in this beforehand. Okay, but did you ever talk to any of the doctors or anaesthetists about, do other people have similar experiences when they're given these drugs?
No, I didn't, but I am still being tested for the drugs I had that day. I go to St. James's for immunology tests.
Okay.
And, sorry, but so far they haven't found what caused it.
Get yourself a glass of water.
It was definitely something to do with the drugs.
Get yourself a glass of water there. I'm going to bring in Noreen. Noreen, what was your experience?
Yeah. Hello. A long time ago, I've told this to a few people. Sorry, I'll have to get a glass of water.
You need to get a glass of water. I'll tell you what you do. Noreen, you go get a glass of water, because this is how this is how many people have called in on this subject. And I'm going to go to David you clear your throat. David, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, Philip. I have my water here in front of me.
You came prepared. Good man. So tell me, what happened in your case?
A family history story more than anything. I was listening to Anya there a few minutes ago, and my mother was born in 1940 in Leitrim, Christmas Eve. And she always relayed the story that after a difficult childbirth and labour, my grandmother became unconscious. And was on death's door, and the doctor shook her, slapped her awake, and she described going towards a beautiful white light and feeling peaceful, and her words were, "What did you bring me back for?" baby daughter is there.
Going to have to rear this child now. Why did you bring me back?
Exactly. It didn't add to the relationship. However, my point was that, you know, this happened in 1940. I'm presuming long before stories like these were shared on the radio.
On the radio, but I mean, it's a phenomenon. It's a story that's out there. Noreen, did you get yourself some water?
Oh yes, I already had it beside me. But anyway,
okay. Well, tell me about your experience.
Do you want the long or the short story?
I tell you what, you give me the middling version of the story.
Okay. Well, I was about 20, and I was mad to ride a horse, and a friend of mine said she'd bring me down and show me how to ride. They had a horse. So I was down in Nina, and the second day, I remember riding around, and this was great, and I was really enjoying myself. And the next thing was I woke up in hospital. That's all I remember. But I remembered after, and I was unconscious seemingly for 3 days, and I had broken my wrist. But I remembered afterwards, when I was riding the horse, I was wearing jeans and some kind of jumper. And my friend Sheila brought me. And I said to Sheila, I dreamt or saw myself looking down at myself lying on this bed kind of table or whatever with a whole lot of people in white coats around me. And I was wearing a slip. In those days, people wore slips. And I had a nice slip. And I said to Sheila, I wasn't wearing that. She said, no, I fixed you up before I brought you in. So it was true. I did see myself in this different item that I couldn't have known about.
And is there any way that you were slipping in and out of consciousness, Noreen?
I don't know. But I remember while I was looking down at myself and these people around me, then I was moving along in the brightness. I was in a lovely white kind of, I won't say tunnel because I didn't feel anyway enclosed, but there was bright on both sides, going towards even brighter at the end. And I was happy, like I wasn't frightened or anything. But I can't say like Anya, because Anya's description was really very similar. I just happened to be doing ironing and had the radio on. I said, that's exactly what happened to me almost. Now, I didn't see any figure at the end. I just saw brightness at the end.
So like Anya, you didn't rationalise, oh, I'm dying, this is what's happening to me now.
No, I was just on this journey and was happy and bright. And I wasn't mad cheerful. I was just aware I was moving along fairly fast.
And there was no anxiety or stress or fear about this at all?
No, absolutely. I was just on a journey. And I don't know how long it lasts, probably a second, I don't know. But I remembered it afterwards, and I've told a number of people, I've called it my out-of-body experience. I don't know whether I was dying or not.
Okay. Anyway, I didn't and what die. Has their attitude been, Noreen? Did they say, it wasn't your wrist you fell on, it was your head, love? Or have
well,
they been?
I did fall on my head because I was knocked out. I was unconscious, you know. So,
But are they generally sympathetic, you know? Noreen?
I don't care whether they are or not. I just told a few people that they are kind of interested in, yeah, I suppose, okay. things. You know, when you're telling your life story.
And how does it... I'm never allowed to tell my life story, but people turn around and walk away as soon as they start. How has it changed your feelings about death?
Well, I didn't have any feelings before that, because, you know, when you're 20, you don't think you're going to die.
Of course not. You're immortal. Absolutely.
No, so
yeah.
I had no fear or anyway of death at the time. But it is a nice feeling, yeah, now to have, yeah. It was all happy and everything. But I don't know. Yeah, I suppose. Well, I don't know what it's like for everybody else, so I don't know. But the very good thing about it is I was at home. This is neither here nor there, but I'm going to tell you. I had my wrist in a plaster, and I had this free. And while I was at home, we had a pub. And one of the Clancy's was getting married and had all their signatures on my plaster of Paris. I'm just so disgusted I didn't keep the plaster of Paris. Anyway, that's my advice.
Not exactly something you could leave lying around the place or slip into an autograph album.
Yeah, but when I heard Anya describing her experience, she described it really well. Yeah. Except that I didn't see a figure at the end now, and I didn't think I was dying, or I just thought I was travelling. And I remembered looking down at myself, lying on this white table and people around me.
Okay. Noreen, thank you very much. And Bea and David. And while we take an ad break, will anybody else who's calling 51551 or 0818 715 815, please get their glass of water sorted out before coming on.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Now, leaving the question of what happens after death aside for one moment, I want to talk to Greg Leonard, who was also listening to Liam the ref who died but came back to us yesterday on the programme. Greg, good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, Philip. Thank you.
Now, contrary to what you might expect, Liam's story brought great joy to you, and not the usual feelings of fear or, oh my God, there, but for the grace of God, go I hope that never happens to me. Why is that?
It was just great news, honestly. You know, with so much sadness around, it was really terrific, you know. And not only that, but I got a message a couple of weeks ago from one of my son's pals, ex-pals. And he said the same thing. They were out at a match and somebody dropped dead and they had a defibrillator there. It was just fantastic. I've been involved with sort of like the charity Cry for a long, long time now. And it's just wonderful. It's just wonderful.
What happened to your son?
He was playing senior football in 2006 and he dropped dead on the pitch, surrounded by all sorts of fit guys, and they tried to revive him and he didn't make it, so he's 29, just got his master's degree. And we didn't know anything about sudden death. You know, the police report, there was a coroner's report and everything. And then Mary Green knocked on our door, and she was our miracle worker, because Mary started off Cry 10 years earlier when her son died as a counselling service. And then she wanted us... anyway, we were the first family to be screened as such in 2006, just before Christmas. They opened up Tala Hospital after hours for us. We were there, the family were there at 4:30, and we didn't get out of there till after 9 o'clock. The staff stayed behind and they screened us, or they examined us, and it was just wonderful. We had a screening unit developed, and years later, well, soon afterwards, in a port cabin there. And then recently, we've got our own screening unit just outside Tala Hospital.
And did that screening process turn up anything in Francis's brothers and sisters?
Well, you see, there was an autopsy and everything. When these when he died, there's no signs or symptoms. The only sign is the heart size increases because it's a muscle. And that's what they put down to. And they reckoned that he had a system or a syndrome, okay. a thing called Brugada syndrome, named after Spanish doctors who affected them in Spain in the early 90s. And it just shuts down the electricity. Okay. You're dead. You know.
It's probably not worth torturing yourself with this. Or is it something that you think about? How different things may or may not have been in his case had there been a defibrillator on the side of the pitch?
They tried everything, Philip. I've sent Lena, is it? No, that's not your girl there. I sent her
the producer,
copy of,
yes.
I Go sent on. Her a copy of one of the reports from the inquest itself. And the guy that looked after Francis was a spectator, a qualified physio, and he did the CPR initially. Mm-hmm. And then when the ambulance came, they did the defibrillator. And there was no sign of it, but, you know. Okay.
But for you, this idea of there being so many defibrillators out there and that they are actually doing the job is just one of those signs of, you know, things are moving forward, we're progressing, we're getting a little bit better at this, and one of the consequences is that there are people who are still alive today that might otherwise have died.
And raising awareness too, you have a look at our website, cry.ie, it's just absolutely fantastic. Do you know how many referrals we had last year?
Go on.
Nearly 6,000. These are people at risk now. And they were referred to this centre. And diagnosed, and just wonderful.
Stay
We're
on
all the, Ireland, all free. It's yeah. fantastic.
Stay on the line, because the CEO of Cry.ie is also here. Lucia Ebbs, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well. Good afternoon, Philip. And hello, how are you, Greg? Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, born in what? 41? Jeebus creepers. Yeah.
I wasn't going to give your age away, Greg. You did that.
41, I know.
And still here and still healthy. But tell me, Lucia, how big a difference does this screening make? What is it catching that might otherwise be missed?
Well, the centre in Tala is looking for inherited cardiac conditions, but I work with the charity, so we've no specific involvement, you know, no involvement in the medical centre. What we're doing is providing emotional support to families like Elsa and Greg. And I have to tell you, Elsa and Greg have been our biggest supporters. I met Greg going back to 2009 in Parnell Park. And he's been, you know, supporting us, plugging us and making people aware. You know, the reality is for most people, until sudden cardiac death hits their families, they don't know what it is. They don't know who we are. And, you know, this is giving us a huge opportunity to get our name out there. So thank you for that. And thank you, Greg, for all you've done, you know, including Greg. And it's not that long ago Greg walked the Camino for Cry. He's been a wonderful advocate for Cry.
Greg?
Going back to the Parnell Park, we just had an information night and it was terrific. But not only that, but we had a soccer player there and he was marvellous. He was just, he was going to sign for an English club. But he had to have a medical, and when they found out he had that, and he has been helping us ever since. You know,
that's
as
Sean Prunty.
He went back to college, yeah, Sean Prunty, yeah, yeah. It's just amazing.
But the difference now, sorry to cut across you there, Greg, but the difference now what we're doing, so when Greg would have found us, there really was no support. Now we have a helpline, you know, funded. We've over 30 volunteers. It's free phone. We're making a difference in supporting family. And like our co-founder, his saying would have been while he was alive was ordinary people doing extraordinary things at the worst time of their lives. And that's what Greg is to us.
Can I betray another confidence, Greg?
No. I was involved with the GA club in
No. You've misunderstood me. I'm going to betray another confidence, a personal detail. Happy birthday.
Thank you. My wife is downstairs. She unfortunately has got a slight problem with Alzheimer's. So
it's a short-term memory. But we're doing great. There's no doubt about it. We've got great support everywhere, GP-wise, everywhere.
And I've done the maths in my head, seeing as Lucia kind of gave the game away there. I have to say, you're a very, very young 84-year-old. Happy birthday to you.
Yes, well, we used to mind children too. You know, babies used to come here. And we had a walk-in age, and we used to take them for a walk in their buggy. That was the walk-in age, dear Philip.
Cry.ie.
No, they're all grown up.
That happens, I'm afraid. Cry.ie. Yeah. See you, Ebbs. Thank you very much. And Greg as well. I'm going to take another break.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Niamh, hello, how are you?
Hello, Philip, how are you? Thanks for having me.
No, thank you very much for taking the call. I'm just going to jump straight to the heart, the very disturbing story or incident right at the heart of this, Niamh. You're a sheep farmer, and earlier on this year, there was a dog attack with absolutely devastating consequences. Describe to me the scene that you came across.
Yeah, absolutely devastating, Philip, as you described it. I described it in the last 6 months as something from a horror film. And I suppose it was 6 months ago, it was in January, and it's still so traumatic to even think about it and talk about it today. I'm a part-time farmer along with my dad, Eamon, in a small farm in Inniskeen in County Monaghan. And on the 19th of January this year, we experienced our fourth dog attack in 5 years, the worst dog attack we've ever had. We lost five of our pedigree Texel sheep, along with nine unborn lambs that they were carrying.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's January, so they were all quite heavily in lamb.
Heavily in lamb. Yeah, we had set up a small nursery field just at the front of our farm. So anyone who's in farming and knows animals knows that sometimes they need a little bit of extra TLC. So we had set up a field that was just for the ones that were carrying triplets or twins or anything that needed any extra help. So in that field, that was where most of the attack had happened. And unfortunately, in that field was my I suppose you can't pick a favourite, but I did have a very, very, very favourite sheep. And she was one I had from when my flock was started back in 2020. And when we arrived that morning to the attack, without giving too graphic details, Philip, it was horrendous with blood and wool and everything everywhere. But when we got there, she was actually carrying triplets. And when we arrived, she was still alive. She was looking up at me and I thought she was okay. But unfortunately, whenever our vet arrived to give assistance, we realised that wasn't going to be the case. And unfortunately, we had to hold her and to keep her steady to let the vet put her to sleep.
And this little nursery pen kind of area, presumably it was a little bit like shooting fish in a barrel for the dog that got in there.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And you know, Philip, it's very important to say too, like for a dog, a dog attack is a chase for a dog. A dog's a predatory animal and they run for the chase, because when they run at a sheep will run. And unfortunately, when a sheep's heavy in lamb, or at any time of the year, but particularly when they're heavy in lamb, they won't outrun a dog.
Mm. So you can obviously end up with very distressed does who then go on to abort their lambs. But in this case, whatever class of a dog it was that got at your sheep, it was savage.
Yeah, absolutely savage. It was horrendous. It was all across the farm. A young ram lamb, a young male sheep that we had, was less than a year old. He was fit and healthy. And he was actually found in a field that was 3 fields away from where we'd left him the night before. A limb lost, a back leg completely gone, blood everywhere. There was animals in drains, animals everywhere. To even start to make a count took us a tremendous amount of time.
Okay. And were there animals in drains that drowned?
No, luckily enough, we had, there was three comrades of that ram lamb that was killed. 3 of them were in the drain. They were young. Unfortunately, afterwards, we lost one of them to pneumonia.
Okay.
And then a ewe as well.
I'm just thinking about the terror of that ram fleeing across 3 fields with a missing limb.
Yeah. Yeah, it's horrendous, Philip. It doesn't even, like, if you try to put yourself in the situation of what it must have been like at the time, I couldn't even imagine it for the animals. Like, they're defenceless, you know.
And have you been able to stop imagining that, to stop thinking about what it was that went on with the animals? Because there's obviously, you know, you're being traumatised by this as well.
Yeah, no, and it never leaves you. And anyone that was with us, my mum, my dad, my boyfriend, everybody that was with us on the day, still talk about the traumatic and the lasting impression, that image in your mind for the last few weeks. Even recently, myself and dad were travelling across the farm and I saw a white plastic bag in the hedge and absolutely lost my life because I thought it was another dead sheep. You know, it just never leaves you. You're constantly looking at them.
And when you say lost your life, Niamh, I mean, are you talking about kind of full-on panic attack, thinking, oh God, yeah, here we go again?
Yeah, full-on, yeah, just upset and distraught over it, really, Philip, to be honest. It's no farmer should have to go through it. And the saddest part about it is, Philip, like, that's my story. I'm one farmer. There are thousands of farmers all across Ireland, 32 counties, that are experiencing this week in, week out.
And you know this, and you can say this with authority, because part of your response to what happened to you was to go and start surveying other sheep farmers.
Yeah, so I decided, myself and dad, you know, that there was no point in sweeping this under the carpet. This was really important to get the message out there and to let people know. And the people in the farming community are well aware that this happens, but it's people in it that aren't involved in farming, that maybe aren't in a rural community, that don't know these things happen, you know, to get the facts and figures out there. So I conducted some surveys.
Headline figure. Give me the big number there. What did you find?
Yeah, the big number. We surveyed 558 sheep farmers, and of that, 73%, so 409 farmers reported having a dog attack on their flock throughout the years.
We've only got a minute or two left, but the bottom line here is that there's an awful lot of people looking at these big, brown, doe-eyed, beautiful dogs sitting at their feet right now and thinking, oh, well, my dog would never do that.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot.
There's very few dogs that won't.
Yeah, there's very few. As I said to you earlier, the dogs see it as a chase, the dogs see it as fun. If you have a dog, I would be urging people, you need to be responsible. Your dog has to be under effectual control at all times. You need to know where they are. Just because you let your dog outside the back door doesn't mean that it's going to be roaming around for the night time in your back lawn. It definitely, most certainly won't in most cases. So it's really, really important. And we've said that, and I spoke to my friends down in the INHFA, and John Joe Fitzgerald has mentioned this as well. You know, when you go out on walks at the weekend for recreational activities, you know, taking your dog up a hill or in a parkland, you can't just let it off a lead.
You can't, because unless it comes back to you in every single circumstance, and there are very few dogs that will actually do that, unless it comes back to you all the time, well, then it's not trained and it shouldn't be off the lead. Niamh, I hate to rush you at the end of this because you've been through an awful, awful experience, but I do wish you the best in trying to put a flock together again. And thank you very much for taking the call.